Chicago's notorious Cabrini Green public housing project is slated for demolition in the next 2 months. The last residents have been moved out so the city can continue to modernize its public housing. You've heard of Cabrini Green. If you don't live in Chicago, it was the setting for the 1970s TV show Good Times.
Good times!
Anytime you need a payment,
good times!
But there were also very bad times. In 1992, a 7-year-old boy walking to school with his mother was shot and killed by a gang sniper. A few years later, a 9-year-old girl, known as Girl X, was found dead in a stairwell, gang graffiti scribbled on her body. Cabrini Green became a symbol for the failure of socially isolated, high-rise public housing towers. The new thinking, build low-rise, mixed-income housing. Reintegrate poor residents back into the city, side by side, with people of all incomes, to incentivize them to move on up themselves. So where are we with public housing as one of the symbols of failed public housing comes down? Joining us from WBEZ in Chicago, D. Bradford Hunt. Brad is an associate dean and professor of social science at Roosevelt University in Chicago. And also Mary Johns, editor-in-chief of the Residents Journal. That's a paper by and for low-income residents of Chicago. She's been living in public housing since 1989, though not in Cabrini Green. She's been living in the mixed housing. And Mary, let's start with you. Did you, as city officials do, see Cabrini Green as a failed symbol of public housing?
Speaking as a reporter, we have discovered other people who suffer the same things. And the question always remained unanswered. Why was this kind of stuff allowed? Why was management failing to continue to maintain the property, meaning the unit conditions, as well as to provide security for the residents so it wouldn't be infiltrated with the influx of gangs who come in and prey on the poor there and bring in the military weapons? Because remember, poor people don't have no money, and they bring in the drugs and they prey on them to help them in their legal underground economy.
Well, Professor Hunt, I want you to jump in here. Why was this allowed? I mean, the criticism of housing like Cabrini Green is that it became isolated, segregated, people were warehoused, and that violence, as Mary said, festered. Why was that allowed?
Well, it's first important to note that public housing developments were not always this way. And for their first 20 to 25 years, public housing developments, like even Cabrini Green, were highly desired by working class and low-income families as really great shelter. We have to remember that in the 1940s and 50s, if you were a person of color, if you were black in Chicago or other cities, you couldn't live wherever you wanted to. And so public housing offered really a step up, and many families clamored to get in. Now, this changed beginning, I argue, in the late 1960s. And what happens is the working class and many low-income families with options start to leave. And what happens is it concentrates poverty. And under the rules set up by the federal government, the government paid to build public housing, and then it turned it over to housing authorities who were expected to maintain and manage the buildings out of tenant rent. So tenants were expected to pay enough to be able to keep the property up. But tenant rents were set as a function of a tenant income, as a proportion of a tenant income. So if you made $100 a month, you paid 30% of your income towards rent, or $30 a month. Over time, housing costs rose, the buildings aged, energy costs spiked up in the 1970s, and tenant rents were not able to pay to maintain the buildings. And everybody realized this. And Washington, the federal government, was supposed to step in with additional subsidies. And they did, but it was never enough. It was very difficult to create a balance between how much do we know is needed to maintain buildings, how much are we, the Congress, willing to pay to housing authorities to maintain buildings. And many of them entered a downward spiral where more working class families moved out. That meant that the rental income to the building decreased. That meant things didn't get fixed. And buildings that don't get maintained, no matter where they are, will start to fall apart. You know, the housing authority became a slumlord in essence. But it was outside the law to some extent as well. If you're a private slumlord in Chicago, tenants can go to court and get a building shut down or the landlord has to pay up or fix the building. But with the Housing Authority, it never really worked that way.
Well, and I just want to say, you mentioned that in Chicago, there were blacks who in the 40s, 50s didn't have a choice as to where to live. We should say that, you know, here in the Boston area, some of the most notorious housing projects were in white neighborhoods. And it seemed to have the same problem, that people who became warehoused in neighborhoods, whether they were in Charlestown, everybody probably saw the movie The Town recently, which talked about the Charlestown housing project years ago, or in South Boston. It was the same idea of people becoming more and more isolated, housing deteriorating, people's lives deteriorating, because as you said, people who could moved out, people who couldn't stayed behind.
And Boston is a really interesting case, and that's exactly right. It's not the racial issues are not as predominant in Boston as they are in other cities, and yet the Housing Authority still went into receivership in 1975. It still struggled through that entire period, in part because it couldn't the Housing Authority couldn't manage and maintain the buildings to any kind of acceptable standard. So there was a structural problem there where the tenants could not possibly pay enough in order to maintain the building.
Mm-hmm. But, Professor, how much of the failure of public housing became what some people are now saying, the fact that people weren't motivated to move out of it because all they were seeing at this point was generation after generation staying in it?
Well, those who could move out did, and that left behind in some ways those who were going to then have a tighter-knit community, many surrounded by family and friends. And I think what you're asking in part is, how much are the tenants responsible for some of the deterioration of public housing? If we concentrate poverty, does that end up contributing to the decline of developments? And I would argue that concentrated poverty is not a good thing, but it's also partially the landlord's fault. Leadership was never there to get out of this downward spiral.
Mary, I want to ask you as well, because that's supposed to be the thinking of mixed income housing. If you see other people of different incomes, you're more motivated and incentivized to try to reach for that yourself. You tell us you are doing better now, and yet you haven't moved out.
Okay, so I make $40,000 and almost pay the private market rent, $1,200 rent. People tell me, Mary, why are you still there? Mm-hmm. It's because I don't have, like, the benefit plan for when you retire. Mm-hmm. And I work for nonprofits, which means sometimes we don't have money to get paid. I have taken also a huge pay cut in order for other low-income people to continue to keep their jobs. I don't have the money saved in order to move yet. People know how to live, how they live, wherever they live. And in terms of mixed-income housing, creating a mixed-income situation doesn't necessarily say a person would benefit one way or another to be able to do better in their lives and to move out of public housing. So being next to a person that's wealthier than me, there's no magical connotation to that.
That's Mary Johns. She lives in public housing and is also editor-in-chief of the Residence Journal for Low-Income People. Dee Bradford Hunt is an associate dean and professor at Roosevelt University in Chicago. And, Brad, the demolition of these towers and the trends toward building mixed-income developments, that's been going on for years across the country. Are people better off?
The early research on this question of mixing incomes and will it rub off? Will people mix and somehow this will help low-income residents find jobs or network? The early research on that is not encouraging to that hypothesis. So what the University of Chicago has been sending researchers to talk to people in some of the newly opened mixed-income communities of Chicago, and what they found is that former public housing residents who've moved back into these new communities are largely staying to themselves, as are the market rate people, we call them, the people who paid whatever the market will bear for a townhouse in that mixed income community. What we do find is that people are safer, things get fixed, that there's more a sense of order. We're not finding a great big happy community. There are tensions between residents, former public housing residents, and the new market rate residents over things like rules for kids with bikes and dogs and music and barbecues and all the kind of things that communities are often wrestling with. But the idea that all of a sudden, oh, what poor people really need is to live next to rich people, that was kind of always, I thought, a rather spurious argument.
Well, we're also reading in some reports that if low-income tenants, like maybe some of those that were moved out of Cabrini Green, are moved to mixed income that also are near good schools, that are in areas that have low crime rates and are near jobs, well, then you have a better chance of everything working well. But if you move into an area that doesn't, those factors override whoever might be living next door to you.
Yeah, the community effects is what the social scientists call it. So how does the community affect the outcomes of families and individuals? The research on this is, you know, I'm not sure it's entirely clear yet, but when former public housing residents were moved to the suburbs, we found some mixed results there. People were safer. People were in better schools. Girls did better. Boys sometimes did not. Residents were happy with their housing situation, but missed some of the community connections that they'd formerly had, perhaps with churches, perhaps with other organizations, perhaps with their friends. When public housing residents move to other poor communities with their voucher after they're thrown out of public housing, they're less satisfied, but it's still a mix. Some are happy, some are not. I don't think we have a real strong sense of whether this ultimately is better in the long run for residents or not. They certainly feel safer, and I think the safety factor is significant, and perhaps that alone. But I'd like to hear Mary on that.
We reported in 2004 that the homicide rates were going up drastically in the areas in which public housing residents were relocating and the crime followed them. So everybody wasn't always safe. People varied in how they have done doing the plan for transformation, as Professor Hunt said before. It's still work to be done. It's hard for us to even track, especially when recently the Chicago Housing Authority itself said that it has lost track of thousands of public housing residents that had relocated out with vouchers.
Well, I just want to explain something, because this is another aspect of public housing, giving people vouchers so that they can use government subsidies but live in private apartments and therefore get out of this sort of warehoused Cabrini Green type of living. But Mary, you're saying the crime goes with them, even though they're not in an isolated Cabrini Green. And you again are saying, why do the police allow that to happen?
Yes, because the Chicago Housing Authority, since the plan for transformation began, they are now paying the Chicago Police Department $16 million annually to provide what they call above baseline services. That means that instead of just protecting them like they should have been while they were in the projects, the Chicago Housing Authority now has the police department providing social services for them, being like teaching them like drama. So they put plays on for the kids. So they call them above baseline services.
Well, Brad, I just want to jump in and sort of, you know, ask, where are we? You know, because the Cabrini Green buildings, these tall monuments, the critics would say, to failure, coming down, were supposed to mark a new symbol. And it sounds as if the methods that housing are moving into, mixed housing, also are problematic, that it's not working that much better.
Well, it's hard to remember sometimes where we were 10, 15, 20 years ago when it truly was abominable conditions. I think that we're fortunate that we've now got a range of solutions. There's now a sense that building communities is difficult, it's challenging. We've really got to devote a lot of resources to it. So this is really challenging. And in many ways, housing authorities are now on the front lines of poverty policy in America. They're trying to dismantle impoverished communities, and sometimes they do it haphazardly or not as well thought out as they should, and then trying to help residents without destroying communities. And Cabrini Green, by the end, lost a good deal of its community. There are going to be some low-rise housing that survives, but those residents lost something. And so how do you wrestle with that as a public policy issue? It's not easy. It's not pretty always.
Mary, can you explain that? You have the last word here. Can you explain to people outside of Chicago, maybe inside as well, who looked at these buildings coming down and thought, finally, and then we heard residents who didn't want to move?
Well, people need a place to live. We don't know the extent of how people are faring under the Chicago Housing Authority's plan for transformation, but people live where they live, however they live. Yeah, home is where the heart is.
Even if other people consider it a symbol of failure. That's Mary Johns, editor-in-chief of Residence Journal, a publication by and for low-income residents in Chicago. D. Bradford Hunt is an associate dean and professor of social science at Roosevelt University in Chicago. Thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, Robin.